The Guardian.
During March, The Guardian's podcasts are sponsored by audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/free download to find out more.
Hello and welcome to Football Weekly. Yes, I am not James Richardson. I'm afraid Jimbo has called off sick. Although, oddly, he looked quite healthy presenting ESPN last night. Anyway, you've got me, Paul McInnes, for the next 40 minutes of football chat. Obviously, it's a somber one this week with the tragedy of Fabrice Muamba collapsing on White Hart Lane pitch on Saturday. We'll be talking about that. We'll also be rounding up the rest of the FA Cup, Premier League, and, of course, the best leagues in Europe. Joining me in this slightly sparsely decorated pod today, it has to be said, we've still got Sarah Palin over in the corner, but I am joined by Chief Sports News Correspondent Owen Gibson.
Morning.
And the wonderful, the irreplaceable, the unique Rob Smythe.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm okay, yeah. I feel a bit bad that not only Jimbo's ill, but Baz can't be here either after a slightly lively St. Patrick's Day.
What, he's Cheltenham and then St. Patrick's Day?
Yeah.
I heard something about a punch-up.
He took a couple of right-handers, apparently. I shouldn't laugh.
Which he tweeted live, so, you know,
yeah,
it's
exactly.
Kind of social media
action. We were sat in a pub on Saturday evening, yeah, exactly, following live updates on Baz's loose teeth.
Minute by minute.
he was born to do that minute by minute. That's the apex of his career.
I think he's okay.
But it's obviously been a very serious and quite tragic weekend in English football, an effect that has spread worldwide. Fabrice Muamba, Owen, could you give our listeners, I mean, depending on when they're listening, I'm sure events will have changed, but can you give us a status report?
Well, as far as we know now, the statement from the hospital hasn't changed. He's still in a stable but critical condition. Owen Coyle, who visited him over the weekend, said it's very serious, and I think that's the best way to put it. I mean, it is very serious, and I doubt we'll get sort of hour by hour updates on his condition. They'll be careful before they say anything. And I think, you know, it's slightly incumbent on, particularly again, sort of in a social media age, it's quite incumbent on people to wait for those updates from the hospital rather than kind of wildly speculating about how he might be.
Yes, and there has been a lot of that, hasn't there? I mean, are we able to draw any conclusions from what happened that day? I mean, it's quite interesting reading this morning about the Ferguson said it, I think, himself yesterday, that how well organised the medical response was on the pitch. And that's kind of actually indirectly a cause of Jose Mourinho, isn't it?
Indeed, the Petr Cech incident, yeah. Which, you know, there was a Premier League review after that, and they ensured that there was this high caliber medical assistance on the ground at every Premier League ground, and we saw that in action absolutely at the weekend, didn't we? And I think that's the one thing everyone said is, you know, kind of if this were to happen, God forbid, almost, you know, the best place for it to happen was on that football field, in a sense, because that standard of care was there. I mean, his heart stopped for 2 hours, extraordinary.
So we live in an age where the game is much safer, where there's a lot more resources put around, you know, both for security and safety of the players and for the fans. We've seen, Rob, fans come together, players come together, and a lot of solidarity being shown these past 2 days.
Yeah, we have, although I'm slightly surprised at how newsworthy that is. I mean, people in football aren't monsters. It would be more newsworthy if they hadn't come together, but obviously there's a kind of an almost blanket compassion, as you'd expect. One thing I would say about Saturday, as well as the ambulance, St John's ambulance people, I thought Hal Webb did really well. I mean, the decision he took was logical, but he acted in a very calm and decisive fashion.
What, to stop the game altogether?
Yeah, and he just looked in control. You know, I mean, you can't begin to imagine how you would feel if you were in control of that game and something like that happened. I just thought he handled it really well.
Police training probably played a factor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And his linesman is an ex-policeman as well, isn't
that right? That's right, yeah.
Okay, well, we won't dwell on this for too long, but certainly, obviously, from everybody at Football Weekly, our sympathies go to Fabrice Muamba and his family. But I guess moving on, let's start with the Cup. We have two decisive results, and perhaps generating more headlines might be your very own Blues, Owen.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, the mammoth return of Fernando Torres.
Fernando Torres is back, apparently. Although he did, you know, it was telling after the game that he said he felt he had a manager who supported him. And, you know, a lot of it, I think, is slightly disingenuous. The post AVB round of interviews. I mean, Frank Lampard did one over the weekend as well, in which he sort of said, well, I've got no problem personally with the guy, but X, Y, Z, you know, and there's been a few of those, but there's no doubt it looks like they've got a weight lifted off them. And it's partly the fact that, you know, kind of, it's an attempt, isn't it, to squeeze one last push out of this set of players. And Torres, I mean, everything, this for much of this season, actually, his approach play has been good. He's been, you know, kind of working the channels. He's been doing everything you expect a forward to do, apart from score. And literally the last sort of couple of months, he's looked like a golfer with the yips. He just hasn't, you know, hasn't wanted to pull the trigger. He's passed and he should have shot and all those things. And I think those goals probably will do him a world of good, you would have thought.
Just out of interest, what are the X, Y, Z things? Because I'm surprised that AVB's strategy wasn't in the first place to try and get one last push from those seniors while developing his younger
players. Well, he basically said that he tried to change things too quickly, that, you know, that he didn't, reading between the lines, effectively said he didn't get those senior players on side. Right. And you're right. I mean, you think, you know, we've talked about this before on the pod, but step one would have been to get one or two key faces in the dressing room on side and then think about how you go about renewing the squad. But it's easy to say in hindsight, of course, you know.
It's incredibly difficult to manage change. Sorry, effectively, Ferguson's done it a couple of times, but I mean, Wenger struggled. I think there's a decent comparison between this Chelsea side and Dom Revy's Leeds side. And you look how they Clough went in and was obviously rejected. And they basically faded. Nobody could manage their transition. They just drifted to nothing. So I have a fair bit of sympathy with AVB. He probably did try to do too much, but I think he was quite courageous in that respect. He could have just looked after his own back and kind of kept things going. It would be such a hard job. I wouldn't envy whoever takes that job.
I think it's quite interesting where Di Matteo is in all of this, though. I mean, he has a certain freedom to be able to do things without ultimate consequence, because everybody assumes he's not going to get the job in the summer. But yet he seems to be making the right decisions. I mean, obviously, John Terry's making them on his behalf. But he does, you know, I think Saturday was an ideal game for him to bring in the younger players, bring in Bertrand at left back, for example, give the senior players a rest, which might not necessarily have happened on AVB. He might play Drogba up front, for example.
And there might be a bit of a lucky general about it, and there might be a bit of the fact he can put his arm around the players because you say it's not going to have the long-term consequences. But I thought that doing the Champions League tie against Napoli too. I mean, he took Sturridge and Matter off, which, you know, any Chelsea fan would say that's a pretty crazy idea, given how they've been two of the best players this season. But it worked, and, you know, and most of his decisions have gone right for him so far. Mm-hmm.
I did have a bit of sympathy for Torres, because I was listening to it on Five Live, and John Motson was getting so giddy every time Torres touched the ball. It was as if he was a 15-year-old kid who won a prize. And I thought, this is someone who was, I think, third in the Ballon d'Or about 3 years ago. It's extraordinary. But hopefully, he seems like a pretty nice chap. And
Hey, John Motson.
Well, I'm sure, yeah, both of them. Hopefully Torres is the start of a decent return.
But it'd be interesting to see whether he plays him in the big games. I mean, he started the Champions League game on the bench, and it was another extraordinary thing was really that we don't consider that a surprise anymore. You know, yeah. £50 million striker starts the Champions League match on the bench.
Right? But I think when you start looking in this kind of transition in a positive, you try and look at it positively, I think having Torres on the bench as an asset to bring on for half an hour, which is, you know, what Di Matteo was very much flagging up after the Napoli game about how much of an impact he made in that half an hour. It could be a very effective tool, you know, providing you get enough from Drogba and the rest of the game. Speaking of people delivering, Luis Suarez, six league goal, Luis Suarez gets another one in a less important trophy, says he's happy to stay at Liverpool. Do you think, Rob Smythe, that going forward they should be building their team around him?
Yeah, definitely. He's their best attacking player, along with Gerrard, who's obviously getting on. I still think they'll have quite a job to keep him, maybe not this summer, but I can't see him staying long term with the current quality of player around him. But I know he has problems scoring goals, but he's an outstanding footballer. You'd be crazy not to build a team around him.
You think he's asked? I'm still slightly unconvinced.
The way he wriggles past people in the box is just, I can't get my head around how he does it. I haven't seen that since Romario. The difference is, of course, Romario was an unbelievable finisher. We haven't really seen that with Suarez. But what's the alternative? If they sell him, then they're left with Carroll and aging Bellamy, Couts.
Henderson in the hole.
I mean, I thought it was fantastic, particularly pre his enforced absence. I mean, it's taken a while to get going again since then. But you'd think, given that, he almost owes him another season at least.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And that was, you know, you did get a whiff of that with the cack-handed PR around that incident. You kind of felt that was really about a strategic thing about what we're going to do as far as in the future. I'm afraid I have to apologise to whoever it was who'd done the tweet, but there was a tweet in response to Guardian Sport this morning saying that is it any coincidence that Liverpool have been doing an awful lot better with Charlie Adam out of the side, and he didn't play yesterday, didn't play in the week against Everton. Two wins.
Yeah, I haven't seen enough to be sure, but certainly the consensus among Liverpool fans I know seems to be that his form has gone off badly.
And, started quite well, didn't they? Sort of first couple of months, but yeah.
But even the 10 million corners haven't been very good lately. If Spearing plays, it gives Gerrard more licence to get forward. Ultimately, you want Gerrard to have that rather than to be kind of sitting and covering for Adam. So, it seems to work.
And you look at Adam, Downing, Henderson, Cow. I mean, you wouldn't. There's not a great strike rate there so far. I mean, you know, kind of it remains to be seen. We could yet fashion them into an alchemy that works. But, you know, by the same token, they've got one trophy in the cabinet and perhaps another Wembley final. So,
yeah, that's a weird thing. They could finish seventh and win two trophies. Do you class that as a good season or a bad season? I don't know.
I was talking about that with my brother yesterday. I wasn't entirely sure. I just thought that fourth was the only thing that mattered for Liverpool, but maybe.
So it breaks the trophy duck there and all that, doesn't it? Yeah.
Mm. Well, Arsenal managed, but then if Arsenal get into fourth, etc., etc. The final quarter-final of the weekend was Everton-Sunderland, 1-1, 2 goals first half, a lot of fouls, Sterling saved by Simon Mignolet. But two sides who appear to be taking the cup very seriously.
It's almost obligatory to call that a good old-fashioned cup tie, wasn't it? I mean, the atmosphere sounded brilliant, and you know, two teams with great histories in the FA Cup and all the rest of it. And yeah, no, I thought it was a really good game. I mean, I thought Everton were a bit unlucky. But.
Normally, when you get a side like Everton or Sunderland as they are now, they get to this stage, and you think there's normally one team you'd be scared of in the competition. Say 2-3 years ago, it was Chelsea. You think realistically, we're going to beat them. This year, I think it's very winnable. The two best sides in the country are out, so I think it's realistic for a team like Sunderland or Everton to harbour ambitions of winning
the whole thing,
which would be an incredible thing. I mean, either way, it would be a nice story for Moyes or O'Neill 6 months into the job.
It'd be great to see Moyes win something, I think, sort of 10 years, all the rest of it, you know.
We're backing Moyes all the way then. I'm going to arbitrarily, out of nothing, call an end to part one now. And in part two, we can look forward to listening to Sid Lowe.
Hello,
Sid. This is Paul McInnes speaking.
Hello, Paul. How are you?
I'm dandy, thank you very much. Well, actually, I'm not. I've got a disgusting gut rot, but I'm about 57% better than James Richardson today, who was quite off sick.
Oh. If it's any consolation to you, I've been ill as a dog as well, so you're not the only one.
Ill from the dog or ill as a dog?
You think worse? Sick
as a dog.
Time.
Sick as a parrot. Hang on, which one is it? I don't know. Sick as a dog,
yeah. One side who might also be ailing was Madrid at the weekend with an unexpected draw against Malaga.
Yeah, and there's a few nice little quirky facts to that, one of which is that it means that Real Madrid, Jose Mourinho, has now not broken the record for consecutive Real Madrid victories, a record held by Manuel Pellegrini, who, of course, was the coach who was up against him last night. So the 91st minute Santi Cazorla free kick, and woof, what a free kick it was, has allowed Pellegrini to that record. It's meant that Real Madrid have dropped points for the first time in 12 games, and it means that the lead is down to 8 points top of the table. The papers this morning have gone for the inevitable headline, I Liga. In other words, there is league. In other words, game on. To be honest, I don't think it is game on at all. I think the whole point was that it meant that Real Madrid had the margin to slip up once or twice. In fact, I think they had the margin to slip up 3 times. I don't think it will happen too many times again, so I don't think it does necessarily open up the league, but of course, for the time being, people are getting quite excited.
And in terms of the performance from Madrid, it was unlucky rather than deserved.
It was a bit of both. Madrid have not been that great recently, particularly away from them. I thought they were very, very lucky indeed to win in Seville against Betis. They were pretty fortunate to win in Vallecas against Rayo Vallecano. And the performances, as I say, away haven't been great. What was striking was that this was at home where they've been battering teams. I mean, they're on an average, I think, of 3.3 goals a game, and the last few games have been a 6 and a 4 and a 5 and a couple of other 4s. So in that sense, it was a surprising performance. Malaga were, I think, the better side in the first half, played some really nice football, wasted the two chances they had, and also seemed to have a refusal to shoot at times. They were trying to walk the ball in, and then Madrid caught them, and you thought, well, it's classic Madrid. They've got so much firepower, they're so good on the break that when teams don't put the game beyond them, when they don't take the chances, Madrid inevitably make them pay for it. But weirdly, the second half, having got that first goal, Madrid then had the chances. They missed two or three really good chances. They had a couple of, one very good penalty shout and one, I don't think, at all penalty shout turned down. And by then, it actually felt like Madrid, I wouldn't say given up, but they drifted away from the game and then got this free kick in the last minute. And it was a really brilliant free kick. Santi Cazorla, officially the best free kick taker in La Liga now. I think that's his fourth goal this season.
Oh, very good. It was also an authoritative away performance by Barca. 2-0 win, another juicy little chip from Messi. How many chips does he score a season? It's just like every time I seem to see him, it's extinct.
It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, there was a moment earlier this season when they dropped points at Villarreal, and there was a little bit of criticism because he was one-on-one with the goalkeeper and dinked it over him and it went wide, and people were saying, why don't you just put it in the net? Why do you have to effectively do something a bit flashy? And Guardiola after the game made a point, and I don't know if he was pointing the finger at Cristiano Ronaldo, but I think he might have been a little bit, because he was asked about this, does Messi over-adorn his play? And he says, if there's one person who does, adornos, in other words, flicks or unnecessary, superfluous things on the pitch, it's Messi. Messi does none, absolutely none. There's never a step over. There's never a pointless trick. If he's chipping the goalkeeper, it's because it's the way that he sees it's the most effective way to score. Yeah, it is something clearly that Messi is A, very, very good at, and B, really quite enjoys. It was a brilliant, brilliant goal. And the nutmeg before it's great as well. Everyone looks at the finish, but the nutmeg that leads to it is superb.
Yeah, I rate him. I do rate him.
He's quite good. I don't know if you saw the game, but the other great thing about it was the dugouts. I thought the dugouts were brilliant this weekend. Sevilla this weekend had been sponsored by a hot dog company, right? So the dugouts were made out to be hot dogs. So if you look at the dugout from above, it was literally the bread roll on either side. The top of the dugout roof was the hot dog with even a nice squidgy squeeze of mustard and ketchup. So I thought that was pretty cool.
So who are the players then? Are they onions in that mix?
What
other garnish you can get on? You can get loads of garnish on hot dogs nowadays. They've gone gourmet. Maybe that's what's happened.
If you go to IKEA, they put a nice sprinkling of toenails on for you.
Fantastic. That's obviously what they are. The toenails, the best paid toenails in Europe. Final match I'd like to ask you about, Sid, is poor old Villarreal and their defeat against Levante, who are still in the Champions League positions after all this time.
Amazingly, yeah. And it's Villarreal that I'm writing about this morning because they sacked their coach yesterday as a result of that second coach they've sacked this season. They're now going for Miguel Angel Lopetegui, or at least I think they are. We're waiting for that to be confirmed this morning. And it's weird because Villarreal, who had only three coaches in 7 years, have now had three coaches in less than 3 months, and that stability is drifting away. And Molina's not a huge surprise. And we talked about this on the pod when Molina took over, and James was asking, what do you think of him? And I said, well, strangely enough, the day that he took over, I spoke to a couple of his former teammates, and they said to me, well, I'm really surprised. Why? Well, Molina's a bit weird. Don't see him as coaching material at all. He's not the kind of person that interacts with people. He doesn't have that kind of force of personality. And one of the other people I spoke to put it even more bluntly. He said, Molina as a coach is a very, very strange one. Why? He doesn't like football. Molina's results haven't been good. I don't think it's entirely his fault. I think Villarreal have genuine problems. But Villarreal, like a lot of clubs, have decided, right, let's go for it, change the coach, see if we can provoke a reaction. Which provoked me this morning in writing this to go through the statistics and see if teams have improved under new coaches this year. And the answer is pretty emphatic, no, they haven't.
Terry Connor syndrome. Can I just ask you quickly, there's a lot of play being given in the UK to Spanish reaction to the Fabrice Muamba tragedy. Mm-hmm. And particularly from Madrid players, they were wearing, obviously, Animo Abidal, which mm-hmm. is, showing support to a big rival, and also their English language T-shirts. What brought that on, do you think?
Just the sheer impact of the images and, the significance of it. I mean, bear in mind that the context in all of this is that Spain has been through this and been through this with really tragic consequences. Antonio Puerta died on the pitch. We had Danny Jarque died, not on the pitch, but in pre-season training with Espanyol. So two players died instantly very nearly instantly from heart problems. Also, Real Madrid have had Ruben de la Red, one of their youth teamers, who was part of the Spain squad at Euro 2008, forced to retire through a heart problem, playing against Real Madrid last night with a guy called Sergio Sanchez, who had heart problems and was forced to pull out of the game for, I'm not entirely sure, I think about 8 or 9 months and looked for treatment, and they did tests and stuff, and he's turned out to be okay. But I think, as I say, so it's a combination of the seriousness of the image and the memory of what happened in Spain. And I think it's impossible to look at those images and for people not to think of Antonio Puerta.
And I guess it just shows that the global nature of the game we're in nowadays, that people watching different leagues at once. So thank you very much, Sid. I see from Twitter last week that there is a new Sid Opus on the way.
Yes, there is, which is
quite exciting.
An absolute nightmare.
A nightmare?
Yeah, because it's all very good. It's all very good thinking about it and doing the research for it and enjoying it. It's another thing writing the bloody thing.
Because it's about the rivalry between Madrid and Barcelona, is that right?
Yeah, although it's evolved quite a lot because, you know, you find that when you go into it, big moments of the history of both clubs don't necessarily always hinge on the other club. So it's effectively a book about the history of the two clubs, loosely hung on the rivalry, but it's evolving into slightly other areas.
Well, that's suitably enigmatic, Sid. Thank you very much. And we will speak to you. Well, I won't, but let's hope Jimbo will on Thursday. Take care, you and your infected hound, until then.
Cheers.
And that's Sid Lowe, dog infection in Madrid. Shall we turn to the Premier League, gentlemen? The most exciting league in the world, and that's partly because of Swansea. Swansea gave a comprehensive shoeing, I would say, to Fulham at the weekend. Did it with some lovely football, and I'm cribbing this from things we learned from the Premiership this weekend, but Leon Britton made 100 passes with a success rate of 96%, and Joe Allen, 91.25%. Barcelona things continue, don't they?
It was death by silk, really. They just passed Fulham to death. It was wonderful. I don't know about you, but I'm developing a massive man crush on Brendan Rodgers. I just think everything about him is wonderful, even the way he wears his tie and his V-neck. But they're just terrific. Britton is a really interesting player because he's got, and I don't normally like cheesy stats, but he's got the highest pass completion of anyone in Europe's top five leagues, just above Thiago Alcantara and Xavi in third, which is extraordinary, you know, for a player who's played all his football in the lower leagues. He was in the Swansea team that, had they lost in May 2003, would have been relegated to the Conference. And he just kept doing it. And you kind of wonder why a player like him isn't being considered for England. He gets the ball, passes the ball to a teammate. It's not a bad system.
No, I suppose. I guess they're waiting for Wilshere, aren't they? But in his absence.
You're allowed to.
Yeah, you are allowed to. And I just must make clear for all Swansea listeners that the reason I don't have a man crush is because you can only have a man crush on one up-and-coming new manager. And mine is Paul Lambert. And obviously, I hate the fact that Swansea are doing so well. They are kind of like... playing such great football with similarly unheralded players and...
In any other season, Lambert would be a shoo-in for manager of the year, wouldn't he?
Yeah, well.
It's interesting, Rodgers is becoming the sort of poster child for the Premier League's argument that you can take a fairly sort of unfashionable club with previously unheralded players and kind of and coach into them a star that would live with some of the best, you know. And I think there's a good debate to be had about whether this is a one-off or whether or not, you know, you'd be able to do it similarly.
I'd be interested to see, you know, next season, let's say that Reading and Southampton do both get up, I'd be interested to see how they fare, because similarly I think you look at them and slightly more experience in the Reading side, but a team that have been playing together for 2 or 3 years in a consistent style with an attacking approach.
But also traditionally is keeping this going beyond one season, isn't it? You know, kind of there's been examples in the past where clubs have come up and we sort of lauded them in their first season quite rightly, but then, you know, sort of second season syndrome is...
Well, I think we're noticing that with Norwich right now, it's that we've got a small squad, and I think maybe to an extent we're being found out, but I think also people are just beginning to flag a little bit as well. So again, you know, more kudos to Swansea for keeping that going. Who are that team? Manchester United. Yeah, Manchester United. They won a game in the league.
Apparently so, yeah. Antonio Valencia kind of beat Wolves on his own. And United are in a scarily good position, given all the injury problems, the relative poverty of the squad. It's quite extraordinary at the moment. Normally in a title race, you think you kind of look for things to go wrong. But at the moment, and it could change so quickly, particularly if Tevez scores a last-minute winner, that could be kind of a big moment. But at the moment, all logic points to United winning the league, which is slightly alarming.
Give me their reasons for that.
Well, they're playing well, City are playing poorly, United's running is easier, they have the experience. United's running is significantly easier, which is a big thing. They should win individually you would expect them to win the next six games. The hardest one is Blackburn away, whereas City go to Stoke, Chelsea on Wednesday, they go to Arsenal, go to Norwich, which won't be an easy game. It can change so quickly, we've seen that before, but everything is going so well for United at the moment.
And the thing that strikes me is just, again, sort of Ferguson proving how well he can manage a squad throughout a season. You know, kind of there's been injuries and all sorts of players in and out, and yet, you know, just at the right time, it seems to be coalescing. Whereas if you look at Man City, some of those look as though they've been, which is extraordinary given the sort of the galaxy of the stars they've got, but some of them look a bit flogged to death.
And they're increasingly reliant on Aguero as well.
I think if you swap managers, City would be 20 points clear. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, Gary Neville said an interesting thing earlier in the season, that Ferguson apparently plans pretty much 10 games ahead with his rotation. Now, he does rotate so much compared to other managers, and as you say, Silva in particular looks really tired mentally and physically. So do a couple of the others. Whereas United's players, partly because they've had rest through injury, partly because they've been rotated, they look pretty fresh at the moment. Mm. And having Valencia back is such a big boost.
Throwing forward, we've got five Prem games this week, starting with Blackburn Sunderland on Tuesday, and then four games on the Wednesday: Tottenham Stoke, QPR Liverpool, Everton Arsenal, and Manchester City Chelsea, which we've already alluded to. Any striking thoughts on any of these games?
Well, QPR have got to start winning some games. Apparently, or at least picking up some points at home, haven't they? I mean, yeah, it's interesting of those teams you mentioned and the relegation battle. I mean, Blackburn haven't quite fallen away like a stone, as some people thought they would. They've sort of kept scrapping, and it's QPR who are really struggling to pick up points at the moment.
Again, when you look at things can change in a relegation battle, when you look at form and momentum and all that stuff, QPR and Wolves look in all sorts of trouble, whereas Blackburn are playing well. Wigan are actually playing quite well. Should have won the last two games. Bolton, yeah, so they're kind of somewhere in between.
Yeah.
At the moment, everything points to Wolves and...
Wigan going down.
Wolves and QPR, I'd say, just because QPR's fixtures are so hard. But we've seen in a couple of years, Fulham did it and West Ham did it. One result can just trigger a crazy run of form to the end of the season.
It's such as the gloom at Molineux at the moment, you just can't see that being Wolves. Yeah. I mean, they were chanting for Mick McCarthy the other week. I mean, that just looks like that's a complete car crash of a season, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks like a disastrous executive decision as well, really, doesn't it, to change like that when they had no guarantee of a replacement.
And Chelsea, Man City, obviously, is a big game, isn't it? Man City, Chelsea, I should say.
Yeah, City's home form's perfect, isn't it? 14 wins out of 14. And they need to, with the way they're playing away from home, they have to just keep winning at home if they've got any chance, I think.
We've obviously talked quite a bit about Chelsea, but I wonder whether three big performances in a week will be possible for them.
Might be a bridge too far, but that race for fifth looking really interesting now as well, with Newcastle obviously just 2 points behind Chelsea. I mean, they eked out another result again. Sort of their squad seems to be falling apart, the seams a little bit, but they keep getting these results. It's extraordinary.
Newcastle.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I watched that game. There wasn't much in it. They weren't really all that hot, but they had a really great performance from Ponas Gutierrez. A couple of distinct and effective tactical changes by Pardew, and then just that quality. I mean, he was quite quiet for the game, Cisse, and Barr was reasonably quiet too, but they both had chances. Cisse scored his, Roddy denied Barr, where they oughtn't to have made the contact and the connection and the chance that they did make in the situation.
Cisse joined Newcastle, I've hardly seen him do anything apart from score two exceptional goals. He scored a storming goal in his debut as well. Yeah, it's quite interesting.
No, and it's funny just how similar they are as well. You know, like rangy but strong, great powerful shot, canny players. Yeah, I think it's very interesting to see where that will all finish. Do we think Arsenal will continue their good run? Five wins on the trot, is it? Four from coming back from behind. Away at Everton, though.
Yeah, possibly. It depends, I suppose, how tired Everton are from Saturday, whether he bothers to rest players. Arsenal, Arsenal's mood can switch so quickly. This has happened a lot of times under Wenger. It seems to be a constant of him rather than a specific team. It used to happen with the Henry team as well, and they look great at the moment.
They're up and down, aren't they? But as you say, it can change pretty quickly.
It's really interesting. He always lauds their mental strength, and a lot of times he's ridiculed for it because they can be so fragile. And yet others, when they've scored last-minute winners in however many games in a row, they're a very peculiar side. I don't know whether that's just down to the way he coaches them and the kind of moral high ground they take. Maybe that makes them fragile, I don't know.
I think it's really interesting that, because I find it very difficult to work out. I always want Arsenal to click back into a kind of consistent performing mode, because I think it makes the league better when they do. But I've grown used to being kind of disappointed in a kind of non-supporter sense as soon as you start putting any expectation on them. That's why I thought the Newcastle result was a really interesting one, because I watched that game. They played really well, and they continue to play really well throughout the game, which is something that I've not seen so much. They had a tendency to get a bit ragged in the last 20 minutes, and the ball was flashing in the box all the time as well, which is a relatively recent development for Arsenal. And I've got my fingers crossed again that they start coming good. But
Well, I think, and it's so important for them as well, that fourth place, because Robin Van Persie, it's so important that he stays. And if he does, that will just there's something you can build that team around going forward. If he doesn't, then it's another kick in the teeth, isn't it?
It is. All right, gents, thank you very much for that. Hey, that's the end of part two. In part three, we're going to be going to Germany. Actually, we're not. We're going to be going someplace in London, but we'll be talking to Rafa Honigstein about Germany, so that'll do. Let's have some Bundesliga chat with Rafa. How many goals in the week is that for Bayern?
Only 20.
Oh, just the 20. Very disappointing.
This is, of course, a club in crisis, so they might have scored a few more. Things were actually working properly there. That was remarkable. week for them, really. First a 7-0 over Basel and then a 6-0 over Hertha, which could have easily been double figures. Bayern were very wasteful in front of goal. They also had 3 penalties awarded. And it was interesting because the whole game afterwards became a giant love-in between the various players, and everyone said just how much fun it is, and everyone hugged everyone. And Robin very graciously gave one of his penalties for Mario Gomez to take because he couldn't take any of his chances. So if you're cynical, and I am, you could say that the big song and dance that they made about this unity in the team shows you just how bad it was before.
Yeah, right.
That there were lots of problems before, which are now perhaps not solved, but at least put aside in the wake of all these goals that they're scoring.
And they've taken Robin back into the bosom of the team, is that right?
Yeah, I'm not sure he's ever going to be anywhere near any bosom apart from his wife's. like to hope, anyway.
Random speculation.
He is just too egotistical a player, and I don't think that's going to change. But, you know, as long as he functions, as long as he delivers, these things don't really matter. It's only when collectively the team doesn't work, then everyone's pointing fingers, and there are still big question marks, I think. Certainly defensively, they look shaky against a really horribly inept side. Hertha were completely useless, but still created one or two chances. I guess now, with the draw being fairly reasonable for them with Marseille, I guess we just have to wait a little bit longer until we find out just what this Bayern are made of, because domestically, when they score the first goal, they seem to win and win big. When they don't, they struggle. And in Europe, they still haven't really been tested. Mm-hmm. Even after all these games, we still don't know just how good they are. And I think it might actually have to take a semi-final against Real Madrid to answer that question.
How is this all going to play out with regards to Dortmund? So I saw the Dortmund game on Saturday night. It was not an effervescent performance, but they seem to be pretty much in control of a game against a reasonably talented Bremen side. Do you think they're going to get the squeaky bombs?
I don't think so. I don't think Dortmund are the kind of team that will start second-guessing themselves too much. They don't play football the way they're so high energy. They weren't in this game, you're right, but they're usually so high energy and all about running and pressing that they don't really have time to think about the possibility of failure. I mean, Werder Bremen were missing a lot of players, Pizarro to name only one, and they didn't really have enough to trouble Dortmund. So Dortmund could rely on a reasonably mediocre performance and still got the points. And, you know, 5 points with 8 games to go is quite a lot. Of course, what will happen in the big showdown? They've got Bayern Munich at home on the 11th of April. And if they still keep in touch, you know, that could narrow the gap to 2. If Bayern were to win, of course, they have to win. And then you might talk about Beckside making strange noises. But I think before then, it'll all be about Dortmund just being a machine and still racking up the wins.
Every time I see him, I'm fascinated by Subotic. And he just looks like a great ball player, but an absolute animal. How highly is he regarded in the league?
He is very highly regarded. He had an offer from Chelsea last summer, which the club turned down pretty quickly. And he's definitely, him and Martumas are seen as the 2 best centre-backs. I don't think there's any real debate about that. I mean, they also work very well as a team. I think that's part of the secret. I'm not sure, you know, what would happen if you plug one of them and put them into another team. But as a partnership, they're brilliant. And you're right. I mean, technically, they're fantastic and they're real sort of all-round footballers, not just centre-backs. And I think in the modern game, where a lot of centre-back positioning is, or a lot of defending is done without actually having a man to mark, and it's all about positioning and intelligence, these two guys are of the very best.
Rafa, thank you very much. Authoritative and charming as ever.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay, so that's bringing us to a close on this truncated Jimbo-free Football Weekly. But before we go, Rob Smythe wants to create a special moment. It's like thought for the day, but it's appreciation of Athletic Bilbao day.
You said you're only allowed one man crush, but I think I've got one on Bielsa as well as Rodgers.
Right, yeah.
Just to say, I mean, we kind of thought Bilbao probably couldn't play any better than they did at Old Trafford, and they did play better. They could have won 6-1. The goal of the right-back, whose name escapes me, nearly scored, was just glorious, almost up there with Pelé from the halfway line, one of the great goals that never were. And of course, it will never happen, but I'd love to see everyone in world football just kind of agree to keep their hands off Bilbao for a few years, keep your grubby mitts away, and just let the team grow, because they're almost all under 23, and they could grow in something beautiful. I mean, we know what will happen. Half of them will end up at Madrid and Barcelona. But it would be so lovely to see that team develop, because they kind of remind you why you fell in love with football, and you don't get that very often.
Totally, and you know, throwing back to what we were talking about earlier about Swansea, I kind of feel the same way about them. And it's like, you know, I've got this dream that Javi Martinez signs a 7-year deal, and then he kind of everybody else follows suit and stuff, and then the two of them play each other in the Champions League in 5 years' time. One can dream, can't they? Well, anyway, on a rather somber Monday, it's time to say goodbye to my studio guests, Rob Smythe and Owen Gibson. For one day only, I've been Paul McInnes, and we'll see you all soon.
Guardian Podcasts, sponsored by audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/free download, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.